Hey there, and welcome to this episode of the GCSAA podcast, presented in partnership with our friends from Enview. I'm Scott Hollister, the editor-in-chief of GCSAA's Golf Course Management Magazine, and I'm glad you could join us for episode 58 of the podcast. For this episode, we are pleased to present another in our occasional series that we're calling The Legends of Turf. The idea behind this series is to spend some time with some of the industry's most respected turf managers to dig into their careers, their impact on golf course management, and their thoughts on the state of the business today. And I think you'll agree that today's guest, Mr. Don Hearn, CGCS retired, is certainly worthy of that Legend of Turf moniker. Don is a 54-year GCSAA member and the current executive director of the GCSA of New England. He was a fixture in the New England golf scene for many years, highlighted by a 29-year stint at Weston Golf Club in Massachusetts. And on the national scene, he was GCSAA's president in 1987, and won the association's Distinguished Service Award in 2008. I've been lucky enough to know Don for many, many years. He's a great guy, a great storyteller, and we were honored to welcome him to this episode of the GCSA podcast that also features Howard Richman, GCM's associate editor, in the interviewer's chair. Time for my usual reminder now about the video version of the podcast that's available on GCSAA's YouTube channel and on GCSAA TV. You can, of course, find the audio version of this and all our episodes on all the usual podcast services. But if you'd like to watch in on the conversation between Howard and Don on this episode, you can certainly do that by checking us out on YouTube or GCSAA TV. And with that, here we go. This is episode 58 of the GCSAA podcast featuring Don Hearn chatting with GCM's very own Howard Richman. Hope you enjoy it.
Hi, everybody. This is Howard Richman, Golf Course Management Magazine, associate editor. I am here today for the GCSAA podcast, and I've got a special guest, somebody I've known since I've been here, my 13 years at GCSAA, and it's a really pleasure for me to welcome Don Hearn, CGCS retired. And I don't know if he's really retired or not, because Don, you've got a lot going on still at your life with the GCSAA of New England as executive director, but we're glad to have you here. We want to talk a little bit about you, you know, some of the things that you've done. GCSAA president in 1987, that's just one of the things that we'll get into, but welcome, and thanks for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome, Howard. I'm happy to be here.
Well, it's wonderful to have you. We'll talk a lot about New England. That obviously is a topic that you know a lot about. You're from there. Tell us a little bit about people that may not know you, where you grew up, the city you grew up, and what life was like for you growing up in Massachusetts.
Well, I grew up in a town or a city called Woburn, W-O-B-U-R-N, and it's about 10 miles slightly northwest of the city of Boston. And I had a great childhood. I grew up in a neighborhood where we were all, now in retrospect, never even thought of, you know, how much money our parents made or what they did for a living other than what they did for a living. And, well, you know, I was real happy, used to pick blueberries up in the woods in the summertime. We had a little baseball field up there. And it was just a great time. And of course, the older I get, I have these flashbacks of when I was younger. And wow, I didn't have a care in the world. And neither did the kids that I hung around with. Or if they did, they certainly kept it to themselves. But it was really, it was great growing up in Woburn. Like I say, never noticed any class distinction. We were all hanging around. And I know it's going to sound crazy because I've not lived in Woburn for over 50 years now. I live about maybe a 30-minute ride from Woburn. But I still consider Woburn my home. I know more about the streets of Woburn, you know, the physical layout of the city with the streets and the street names, than I know my own neighborhood, which I've lived in for over 50 years. Because in this neighborhood, when I was working as a superintendent, I would get up in the early morning and head like a dart down to work. And the same thing at the end of the day or the early evening, I just head back to home. And of course, I didn't grow up in this neighborhood, so I wasn't, you know, walking through the woods and knocking on my friends' doors. It was just, you know, different back then. But I had a great life growing up. Nothing was miserable for me, or maybe I was miserable, but there was nothing miserable in my upbringing. Did I say I wish it never happened? Maybe one thing. My father, he liked to drink a lot, but even then, it was he was a good guy, I thought. But that's a little bit about, you know, where I grew up and where the town was located, or still is located, where I grew up. And I still go over to Woburn Country Club every once in a while, and, you know, see some of the people that I've met over the years, and see people that knew my dad even. There's still, some of them are still living.
Who introduced you to golf, Don?
Actually, my dad. My father played golf like many of his friends. And a couple of things stand out in my mind about Woburn Country Club. I believe I was 9 years old, and I have this place on Woburn Country Club in my mind, indelibly imprinted. And I was leaving the seventh green, and I was just walking along with my father. I think it was a weekend, and he probably told my mom, hey, I'll give you a break and take this little squirt over the golf course with me. And maybe he had taken me over there many times before, but this one particular time has stood out for us, you know, all the years that I've lived. And anyhow, we were walking from the seventh green up to the eighth tee, slight incline, maybe 200, 250 feet between the green and the tee. And he turns to me and he says, you want to carry the bag? I said, yeah, absolutely. He put the bag on my shoulder. I almost fell down. I said, this is crazy. What am I wishing for? So, you know, I don't know what to do. I couldn't say, oh, it's too heavy, I can't carry it. So I tried lugging it up to the rest of the incline to the eighth tee. And he says, whoa. Give me that. You're not going to be able to do that. So I just walked the rest of the way with him. And I don't know, you know, how many years later it was. And there's probably a gap in my, I'm sure there's a gap in my memory. But that's something that's always stood out in my mind. And the first round of golf I ever played was at Woburn Country Club. And it was in the attic of our home in Woburn. I found an old bag because my grandfather used to play. He lived in our house, and in fact, he died in our house, which I guess wasn't uncommon, you know, back then. And I was out with my dad, I forget where we were, and came back and pulled in the driveway, and I knew something was up. There was some strange vehicle there. I don't remember him telling me specifically that his father, my grandfather, passed away, but obviously I came to know that. So he was a golfer, and so I went up in the attic and rummaged around. I found this old golf bag. It was an ugly piece of a golf bag, but I didn't care what it looked like. And I think my mom dropped me off over at Woburn Country Club. And the golf pro there at the time was a fellow named Sammy Vedetta. Real, real nice fellow. And he had a collection of lost and found clubs. I don't know how many he had, but he cut them down. He cut a driver down. I wish I took a photograph of it now, but I have it again embedded in my head what it looked like. And he cut it down to my size, put a new grip on it, and I had found some old wooden clubs. One of them was a wooden shafted club, a wooden shafted putter rather, upstairs, you know, again looking for a golf bag that were my grandfather. So I stuck a few of them in that bag, and he stuck a few more clubs. I'm going to guess I probably went out and had, I don't know, maybe five or six, seven clubs in my bag. And I was all by myself. I played all day long, and it was a rainy, off and on rainy and misty day. So there was no one out there. I mean, literally, there was no one out in the golf course that I can recall seeing. And I think the first nine hole round that I played, I was 113. I mean, I could have been 413. It didn't matter. I was happy as I guess a snake could be in tall grass. It was just great out there playing. And, you know, I just don't remember, you know, the physicality of the day. Again, I remember going down the seventh hole, hitting a couple of shots from the tee. 113, and I don't remember the rest of the day. Maybe I was just euphoric of over, you know, what I had personally accomplished, and it didn't really matter where the ball went because I caddied so long over there by that time that, you know, I picked up a swing and putting stance and, you know, the lingo and stuff like that. So I was just a happy kid. And I just loved being around the golf course. I was excited, like a lot of people are, when I found a golf ball. Didn't matter whether it was an old Pinnacle or I'm trying to think of some of the old balls that, you know, were in vogue at that time. Titleist, you know, I think they had a Titleist red, Titleist black ball. Now, I mean, I don't know how many versions of Titleist there are out there. But anyhow, that's a little bit of my background and, you know, how I got actually hooked into golf. And I guess we'll talk about other things maybe related to what I just said as we go along.
Yeah, we'll get back to Warburton in a little bit, Don. What, you were there from 1972 to 2000, so you were there for a long time. But tell us how you got into this industry. What made you want to come and be part of this for so many years of your life?
I think what it was is what I used to do as I got older, I worked at Woburn Country Club. And then a friend of mine, actually a neighbor, he got the management contract. I won't bore you with all the details of how the golf course ended up being operated the way it is right now. But anyhow, he got the maintenance contract. Excuse me, he got the management contract for the Woburn Country Club. And, you know, I grew up right next door to him and the whole family. I knew the entire Daugherty family / Connolly family. And anyhow, I used to work on the golf course in the spring and in the fall. And in the summertime, I'd work inside the golf shop during those particular years. So, you know, I, like many people of that age, thought that maybe I too could be a golf pro. Not anything on the tour, but, you know, a club pro. And then I realized, I mean, maybe the best my handicap was probably maybe a 6 or 7. That's the best that it could ever be. I mean, I had no shot at winning the state amateur or any of that stuff. And for some reason, I don't know what it was, but I started gravitating toward the maintenance end of the golf course. I just don't know what it was. But anyhow, I liked it more and more. And I disliked more and more working inside the shop. So then, and I've told this portion of this story a number of times. I remember being in the maintenance building, and there was a copy of Golf Course Management. It may have been called the Reporter mm-hmm. back at that time. And it was on the desk. I have no idea where it came from. I just walked by and it just caught my eye. And I believe on the cover, I believe was a picture of Sherwood Moore. Mm. So whatever time, I know, I forget the years that Sherwood was on the board and the president. But that would, I think, somewhat date, you know, what my mind was, or where I was in my life and my age. And I read that magazine, and I think it had something to do with either pension plans or retirement plans or financial planning that Sherwood was involved in with some other people. And I think that was the gist of what that magazine, that issue was about. Anyhow, it attracted me because I had no idea that there was a magazine. I had no idea there was an association of golf course superintendents, locally or nationally. I just figured everybody went to work like everybody else. But anyhow, that's what, you know, caught my eye at first. And I read it and I became more interested. And why? It wasn't like, you know, I came out of the when I was born, that somebody, you know, imprinted a message on me and said, you're going to be interested in X, Y, Z, and this is why. I don't know why I got interested in it, but I really did. And then I realized that there was a school that you could go to. And I wanted to get out of school. I didn't want to go to school. I wanted to get the heck out of high school and just, you know, make a few bucks and buy a new car. And, you know, life is, obviously for all of us, probably life back then is different than it is as we get older. because back then we're bulletproof. Nothing's going to hurt us. We're going to live for as long as we want. And if we die tomorrow, big deal, who cares? Of course, the older you get, you really change. You change that tune pretty quickly.
Right.
But anyhow, I found out, and I don't know how I found out, but I found out about the winter school. That's what it was called at that time. It was a 10-week school at Stockbridge at UMass Amherst. And I applied. The first year I applied, I was naive. I'm probably still naive to a certain extent, but I just went through the application process and I was turned down. You know, I was disappointed. And then I talked to a couple of people and they said, well, you know, who do you know? I said, well, what do you mean? Who do I know? Well, do you know Joe Troll? Because Dr. Troll was, he was the man. And I said, well, no, I don't. I never met him. I don't know who he is. So he said, well, I forget exactly who it was that said what, but supposedly they had mentioned something to Joe Troll about this kid that had applied and maybe you could give him another look next year. So they encouraged me to apply the next year and I did get in. And I just loved it. I couldn't get enough of the schooling because it was something I really liked rather than when I was in high school. You know, I didn't like most of the stuff because I thought I was just as smart as a teacher. What am I doing? I'm wasting my time here. Let me go out and do something that I want to do and that I can learn something that I literally know nothing about that really interests me. So I went to the winter school, and when I was going there, one of my friends, Dick Conley, was talking to the superintendent at Lexington Golf Club, because he also grew up in the south end of Woburn, where I grew up, as did Dickie. And somehow in their conversation, Teddy Murphy was a fellow's name at Lexington, he told Dickie that he was looking for an assistant. So I don't know exactly what their conversation entailed, but Dickie called me afterwards and he says, hey, geez, if you're interested in becoming an assistant at Lexington, I said, give Teddy a call, which I did. And met with Teddy and met his wife. And I think I don't know if he had any kids at that time. And he had a pool table in the house and I loved to play pool. And we played pool for hours. And we ended up learning a lot about each other. We knew of each other, but we never knew about each other. So I worked for Teddy for a couple of years at Lexington Golf Club. And then his dream came true, and that was to own his own golf course, golf facility. And he bought a place in Haverhill, Massachusetts, called Garrison Golf. And he's taken it over. And where it's located, they call it the Merrimack Valley. Virtually everybody in the Merrimack Valley knows Teddy Murphy, know the Murphy family. Just a wonderful, wonderful human being who I learned a lot of things from. And then when he moved on, I was fortunate enough to get the superintendent job there. And I stayed there for 3 years. And then Weston opened up and I went over to Weston.
What was it about Weston? You go there in 1972. What was the allure of that? When did you know, when you were talking to them about the club? Had you been there before? What did it turn out to be? What made that so special to be there for almost 30 years?
It was considered, at that time, a real good club to be at. And my predecessor, Phil Cassidy, who happened to be a board member, I forget what year or years, but he was a board member of GCSAA, way back. And Phil is just a nice, nice human being, a very quiet, a gentlemanly type person. And I got to know Phil a little bit when I joined the association. And, I always liked Phil. And it was funny because, when I say every year, this is a slight exaggeration, but every year the rumors would start that Phil was going to retire at Weston. And boy, that's a great job. Well, as fate would have it, when I worked at Lexington, one of the green chairmen at Lexington was also a member at Weston. So when Phil did retire and made it official that he was retiring at a certain date, I was up at, this is crazy. I was up at Sears Roebuck, which was in the mall at Burlington, Massachusetts. And I parked my vehicle and I came in to the back entrance to Sears. And at the counter, waiting to pick up a piece of equipment or something that he had ordered, was this gentleman. He said, hey, how you doing? Hey, how you doing? Pop, 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 pop. He says, Phil's leaving Weston. He says, I'd like very much for you to apply. No, I says, Phil's not going to leave. I says, you know, he just hired this fellow as the assistant who was a superintendent at a 36-hole course. So we all thought that that person was going to become the superintendent. And I said, nah, I said, that's not going to happen. He says, it will. I said, well, how do you know so much? He says, I'm on the search committee. I said, wow. So anyhow, make a long story short, I applied for the job just like, I don't know how many other people. And to my surprise, the chair of the search committee called me and he said, they'd like to come over and look at the golf course, blah, 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 which they did. And then they narrowed it down to, I don't know how many people, and invited those people to come over to Weston to make a trip around the golf course there, which I did. And, you know, then afterwards was a little bit of an interview. You know, Zoom didn't exist and all the technology didn't exist to communicate with each other. So it was either a telephone call or a physical meeting. So it was a physical meeting. And then lo and behold, they chose me. And, you know, I was on a cloud for a while. So anyhow, that's how I got the job. It wasn't like I knocked on a door or, you know, they came out. If I didn't have that fellow in my corner, I don't know. My hunch is I wouldn't have gotten the job, but I don't know that for a fact. But I don't want to say, well, I got the job because I was the most qualified. Even back then, I didn't think I was the most qualified. But doesn't matter. Who knows? Maybe I was the most qualified. So I got the job, you know, for, I don't know, the longest time. Every time I go to work, you know, I said, geez, this is great. I'm really happy. It is a good club. And then as time goes on, things change. And sometimes they change for the better. Sometimes they change for the better for a period of time. Sometimes they change for the worse. Then you have more of the good days and the bad days rather than mostly good days as time goes on, which is just a natural occurrence. I think that's the way life goes on in probably most endeavors. But, you know, and I enjoyed the people there. I had a good time. You know, they supported me, you know, doing what I do locally or what I did locally as well as nationally. And I was blessed with a good staff. Back then, we didn't have to worry anywhere near to the extent that we do now about where we're going to get people to work. It was a lot easier back then. So anyhow, I met a lot of people from the club, some I still see. I got involved in a lot of outside activities at the club with, at that time it was called the Mass Golf Association. Now it's just Mass Golf. Got involved with the We Met, the local, and then the national, and the rest, as they say, is history.
What was it that brought you to want to climb the ranks, so to speak, at GCSAA until you became president in 87?
I think it was when I went to the winter school in 68, I believe Norm Kramer, who passed away suddenly, not too long after he came to the Stockbridge School, and Dick Blake, they were both presidents at the time that they were invited to be at the conference. Joe Troll put on a turf conference, and obviously all the winter school graduates would go there, and they'd have a banquet afterwards and a keynote speaker. And Norm Kramer was one. He was a very dynamic guy, kind of a big guy. He always, a good guy, nice guy, always had a presence about him. And then Dick, you know, Dick was like the hero in my area because he was the president of GCSAA. And by coincidence, one of my classmates in 68 was Bob Osterman, who was a past GCSAA president.
Right.
And we got to be very friendly because he at the time was an assistant working in Connecticut, and the superintendent he was working for, I had worked for, because he was a superintendent at a club up in the Boston area. So we had a lot in common. And we almost kind of both had the same thoughts going through our head, looked at each other and said, hey, someday I'm going to be the president of this group. He says, yeah, but it's going to be after me, or some crack like that. But from that day forward, again, that's one of those things that sticks out in my head. From that day forward, that was my goal. I never wrote anything down like my goals are X, Y, Z, or my life plan is A, B, C. And in 4 years and 4 years or 12 years from now, I want to be doing X. The only thing that I can remember goal-wise in my profession was I wanted to become the president of GCSAA. I had no idea what, you know, what it was all about, how it ran. I had no clue, but that was my goal, to become the president. So I did whatever I could, try to get on as many committees as I could, get to know as many people as I could, and, you know, become acquainted with people who might help me do that and might, you know, realize, well, you know, maybe this young guy out here, maybe he will be able to do something for us, and maybe he's a flop. I like to think it wasn't a flop, but I don't know what other people think of me.
Right.
So anyhow, that was my goal, you know, as far as this association or this industry and profession is concerned. And I stuck with it, and my goal was realized.
That's neat. Well, I'll read kind of what was written about you back then when you're about to become president. You said you weren't going to make any campaign promises, only to direct 100% effort to making the profession a better place for my peers to practice their expertise.
Yeah. I said that?
Yes.
Somebody must have written that for me. No, yeah, well, that's how I felt. I mean, I still, you know, if those words were repeated to anybody, I wouldn't be embarrassed or have to say, oh, I didn't really mean that, or that wasn't really me. No, that's the way I felt. You know, I like to think that I'm just a regular guy, just a grounded person, and with, you know, no pretension and no airs, and try to treat people the way I'd like to be treated. And I get upset when people are treated not properly. It's none of my business how people are treated, but sometimes it bothers me the way that some of the stories that I hear. But anyhow, yeah, that's the way I felt. I didn't know those were the words that I said, but that's me.
You know, besides being president of the National, there's a laundry list of things. So you were on the USGA Green Section Committee. You were appointed to the National Golf Foundation's Commission on Public Golf Course Development, and just a lot of things that you're involved with to make this industry go forward. In 2008, you were our Distinguished Service Award recipient. What did that mean to you?
That was cool. I think it was Ricky Heine who called me. And in fact, I was leaving my friend Dick Conley's house. I was getting ready to get in my vehicle. And there was something going on at GCSAA where Ricky calling me wasn't uncommon, because he was the president. And they were discussing something. I forget what it was. So when he called, you know, I figured, well, maybe he was just calling to get my opinion on whatever it was they were discussing. But anyhow, he told me that I had won this award. And I said, hey, Rick, I said, you called the wrong number. I said, you know, no way. He says, yeah, you get, you know. So obviously I was, you know, I felt proud that somebody had the initiative to do that. And somebody else or a group of other people had the wherewithal to agree with them, or at least the majority agreed with them, I guess. And I was proud of it. Well, I'm still am, you know, not back then. I was extremely proud, just as proud today as I was then about that. I don't think about it all the time. But yeah, I was a happy guy. It's really, it was a wonderful honor to be bestowed on me.
We'll get back to this episode in a minute, but now a word from Enview, a gold-level GCSAA partner that is committed to working with golf course superintendents to accomplish great things on the course every day. The company has the expertise and innovative solutions to help you meet the challenges of maintaining your course through the winter to make sure it's beautiful and playable next spring. December is a great time to analyze the results of your 2023 Cool Season Turf Management Program to learn what adjustments to make for 2024. For example, you can study the effects of unusual weather and how your strategies performed. You can also review the performance of your primary applications and make adjustments. And you can always reach out to the Enview team for support and expert assistance. Warm season superintendents know that December brings challenging weather conditions, but it's also a great time to proactively protect root health and maximize photosynthesis. Consider Signature Extra Stress Guard Fungicide for proven Pythium control that can increase chlorophyll, photosynthesis, and root growth. And to protect your roots from underground threats, apply Resilia Root Health Solution. This all-in-one product works well in combination and rotation with Stress Guard products to keep your turf protected and healthy. Contact your NVU representative or go to us.nvu.com/golf to learn more about agronomic solutions that can help control weeds, diseases, and soil-borne pathogens this winter for a more beautiful, playable course in 2024. Always read and follow label instructions, and remember that not all products are registered in all states. Once again, our thanks to everyone at NVU for their support of the GCSAA podcast. And now, let's get back to this episode.
Another aspect of your life that you really became interested in and entrenched in, you like to write. And that's something you've done for a while now. You've written for GCM Magazine in the past. And I'm sitting in the building right now that's been here since 1991 at headquarters, but there was a time you were here when we were in another building here in Lawrence that you went to. It was a newsletter editor seminar. Do you remember that?
You know, I don't remember that. I mean, I remember the building, but I don't remember that. But I'm pretty sure that that did happen.
Yeah. Was that important for you to exceed and excel in writing? Is something that was important to get the word out for your peers, for New England in particular? Or how did you view that?
No, to me, writing was like speaking in front of an audience. I felt that virtually most of what I wrote, I felt that I sort of like fell on my face, because I mean, I don't have a background. I didn't go to college to become an English major. I didn't take classes at night to learn how to write. And I realized that the more I read about things, and the more I listened to people, the ones that I admired the most were the ones that wrote like they spoke. And, you know, whether the spelling was incorrect, whether the syntax was incorrect. When I was a younger person, I think I'd be critical. And I'd say, Jesus, how can somebody, you know, not proofread? Well, how can somebody write something like that? But then, you know, you realize there's other things in life to concern yourself with. And I feel the same way. It's not that I don't care. I care a lot. But I might think, yeah, that sounds pretty good. And then I look at it again and sounds, well, I'll change this and it sounds better. But I don't know, because very, very few people get back to me or probably to anybody else and say, boy, that article you wrote really was awful. Or, you know, that particular part of it was awful. The only thing that people express to me with rarity is, oh, geez, that was a good article. And I say, you know, they didn't say which one. I don't know which one they're talking about. And then when I quiz them a little bit, they can't really remember what the article, they can remember what the article was about, but they can't really remember why they liked it, but they liked it. And however it was written, it really didn't matter, because I could have had the most astute English writer use his or her words and say exactly the same thing that I was saying or writing. And Christ, I'm not going to even read that. That's garbage. But that's the way, you know, that's the way it is. So yes, I write. Writing's hard for me because it doesn't come naturally. And what is happening is the more I do it, the less fearful I become of people snickering at what I write. Because I can always say, well, when you send your first article in, I'll be happy to edit it, or I'll be happy to comment on it. But I try to encourage people, because most say, when I ask them to write something about what they just told me that I thought was interesting, Jesus, I said, you know, why did you write that? We'll put it in the newsletter. Nah, I can't write. I said, well, neither can I. I said, but at least I throw stuff in the newsletter, you know, every 2 months now. And I says, you know, some days I enjoy it and sometimes I don't. Sometimes it's a hassle. But, you know, you should do that, because you tell me, I can't remember everything that you just told me to tell somebody else. But, you know, you gave me some ideas. And I'm sure that if you gave me some ideas and some appreciation of what you're doing, others will be even more appreciative, because they're actually still doing it. They're doing what I used to do. So that's my experience with writing. I don't consider myself a writer, but I like to contribute.
That's awesome. Well, you have the experience, 54-year member of GCSAA. you've seen a lot through the years. How has the industry changed, transitioned, technology? What are some of the things that you've seen that you think have really benefited, things like you maybe like to see in the future? Where does it stand now for you?
Well, to me, the biggest change that I think that's occurred during my time in the profession is computerized irrigation. To me, that's number one and still is number one, but it might drop as time goes on. And I'm just ecstatic about these robotic mowers. In fact, I forget the publication, the online publication that I saw, but I just saw two more from two companies that are not, you know, turf companies. They're not from Jacobson, Toro, or John Deere, or Baroness, or some other. They're just some other company that is probably tied in with a technology company that provides the technology to operate these mowers. They don't look anything like the conventional mowers that we see mowing fairways. But, you know, the mowing units are like what we have. And to me, that's a whole new horizon. And people say, well, yeah, but you're going to get rid of jobs. Well, who isn't complaining now about not being able to hire enough people? And it's not that people aren't available, because people are available. But, you know, when you look at the working conditions that people have to go to in some of these facilities, they're horrible. They're horrendous. And, you know, if you go to a club member and they think it's a wonderful job because they see you on the golf course. Well, when they're on the golf course, most times it's a nice sunny day. That's why they went to play that day. Say, boy, I wish I had this kind of office. This is great. Yeah, it's great right now. But when it's cold and it's rainy and it's windy, the bunkers have washed out and you're complaining because you can't move the leaves fast enough. I said, you know, it's not really that good a job. It doesn't equate to what you think it is in your mind. Benny, I'm getting a little bit off track here. I'd say during my lifetime, the number one invention or conversion is automated computerized irrigation, because I go back to the days of night watering in cold mornings, putting snap valves in and wind blowing the water on you. I can't think of the word right now, but the technology involved with the spray units that are GPS controlled, some of the mowing equipment the automated Greensmore, Cub Cadet, I think, was the company that eventually bought it. Whether that will come back or something else will come back to take its place, I'm sure it will. I don't know what it will be looking like or how it will be operated. But even now, the autonomous mowers, the robotic mowers, I guess a lot of them now, instead of having that little wire around the edge of the areas where the mower is not supposed to go beyond, I've been told that that's being done or has been done away with in many cases. So they're becoming more and more streamlined. And I listened to a podcast not too long ago, and I think it's John Mearsman down at Philadelphia Cricket Club. He's got a bunch of them down there doing a bunch of different things. And, you know, he's very excited. And he made it a point to mention that they didn't do it down there to save the labor. So they did it for a number of reasons, I'm sure. But one of the big reasons is they can take the staff they have today and spend more time doing other things on the golf course that may have been needed, or now that they did them, people appreciate them, rather than, you know, bringing in a dozen mowers and laying off, I don't know how many people they replaced, but laying off a couple of people. He said that they didn't do that. So others who right now are understaffed and they're stretching and they can't get everything done because they just don't have enough people. In a situation like that, robotic mowers might be their answer. And as time goes on, they're going to get better and better. The cost is high, no question about it. Mm-hmm. At what point they'll come down to the range where, you know, they're cost effective? I don't know when that will happen. I'm sure the manufacturers will tell you it's already happened, but I think in reality, it's something that we'll be looking for in the future. So those are the things that really stand out in my mind. I mean, I can remember like top dressing. the top trusses that we have now, we've got tractors running over the greens. Well, back, you know, when I was in the early stages of my career, we would never think of rolling a green, we wouldn't even think of how we could do it to drive a tractor over a green. Nah, you're going to ruin the green. And we used to by hand shovel the sand onto the green. And I worked at one club where they had an old timer at the club, and he would go into the woods and he would find birch branches and he would make a broom and he would hand sweep as many greens as he was allowed to do. He would hand sweep them with this broom. He would hand sweep the sand in. I'd never seen it in my life. I've never seen it before, never heard of it, and I've never seen it or heard of it after that particular situation. And, you know, we went from there to the top dressers that went on the back of the Cushmans, or actually before that, the Meat-O-Matic, and then the adaptation that put them on the back of the Cushmans. And now we've got the rotary type sand applicators, and many fellows are using the rotary spreaders to hand apply, you know, some, I guess, weekly or every couple of weeks, the light sand top dressings. So, you know, virtually all the equipment is just the tractors themselves have just evolved into different pieces of equipment that back in my early days, I just couldn't even imagine it. Couldn't even get the computerized irrigation system. Couldn't imagine it. It was just crazy. I mean, it's nuts. And I now, I've been retired for a number of years, but I'm on the course rating team for Mass Golf. So I probably rate maybe 10, 12, 13 courses in the course of a season. So I always try to contact the superintendent before I go there and meet up with him, because they've all been him so far. Just shoot the breeze. Most of them are members of the association, but a few aren't. And, just put their fears to rest, because they think, as I did too, until I really knew about it, I used to think that it was a bunch of low handicap golfers who thought that they were experts in, you could name something, they could fix anything, they could fix bridges, they could do everything. And that they would subjectively rate a course from the standpoint of, this is a good hole, this is a bad hole. And those kinds of arguments would go on for eternity. But then I found out how it actually happens. And I love doing it. And why I love doing it, another one of those mysteries in life. I don't know, but I love it. But when I go to the courses, I look at the golf courses in an entirely different way than I looked at them going to a monthly meeting. Because then I was comparing what I saw with my golf course. Now I don't compare it with anything. And I admire much more so the beauty of the golf course and the conditions that the superintendents are providing. It's crazy. Even at, a relatively low budget public golf course, the greens on virtually all the courses that I've seen so far, and I've been doing it for 10 or 12 years, so I've seen a lot of courses. They're magnificent. They're works of art. And, in a way, it's so sad because, this, depending on the number of tee sets on the course, there could be 14, 16, 18 of us involved in a rating one day. And they're interested in their perspective is from the playing of the game. And most of them have absolutely, positively no clue about what a golf course superintendent does, other than they work on the golf course. And they have no clue as to how the golf courses end up being the way that they are. And I get this sad feeling in my body that all the work that goes into it, since I know what goes into it, and it's just totally unappreciated. Not that people want to underappreciate it, or not appreciate it. They just don't. Their perspective is different. Just like mine is entirely different from theirs. And every once in a while, I'll say something, there might be a beautiful sculpturing of the land, beautiful to me anyhow. And I'd say, geez, in fact, this did happen. I was with a woman, Rita, and she's a very avid golfer and plays a lot of courses in various leagues and what have you. So I mentioned to her, I said, geez, you know, isn't that a beautiful piece of work out there, the way that the land is sculpted? And she says, and it was almost like I was talking to myself, because she had played that hole not too long ago before we had been there. And she was telling me how difficult it was for her. No appreciation for the beauty of the land, none whatsoever. So I said, oh, okay. I guess I have to understand why to her. Didn't matter. She lost the hole. So their perspective is a little bit different. And it's really sad to see all the work that these people are doing on these golf courses. And there's just so little appreciation for it. You know, unfortunately, yes, we've come a long way. But I'm not sure that we're ever going to be, you know, like, as I don't know where we should be. Does somebody have like a measuring stick that's, 4 feet tall, and we're at the 3 foot level and we started at the 1 foot? I don't know at what level we'll be at when we as a group of people are happy that we finally reached it. I don't know what it is. You know, is it having, 35,000 members? Is it, I don't know what it is that we can go to and look at and see that, wow, we're really getting there. Because I don't know, you know, where there is. And I think that as we move along upwardly, other professionals in our industry are also going to, in the game, are also moving forward. You know, just, you know, it's a tough race, I think, that we're in. And, you know, for somebody to deny that we're not competing against our fellow staff members in many cases, I think that's folly. We are. And, you know, I've yet to meet anybody that said, no, I don't want to be any better. I'm happy. Well, I've met a lot of people who say I'm happy where I am. And I'm one of them. I'm happy where I am. And somebody else could look at me and say, well, you know, that's not really cool. You should be goal oriented. And when you reach that goal, you should be happy you reached it and then look for the next one. Some people are made that way. I'm not. But anyhow, I'm probably rambling a little bit too much now, so I'll kick the soapbox away.
I was going to ask you, so when the GCSEA conference and trade show is held coming up in Phoenix here at the end of January, it's the first time in more than 30 years we'll have been there. And it's, yeah, I'm guessing, a special place for you, because in 1987, when you were elected president, that's where the show was held.
Yeah, right, right.
What, any memories of being there then, and what does it mean to you?
Yeah, I remember it being rainy. I really do. The biggest thing was rain. You know, I'm sure that the city has changed dramatically since then. I just remember our hotel was, you know, close enough that we could get there without getting soaked. But we did have a lot of rain that particular time, which obviously was unusual for Phoenix to begin with. And other than that, you know, I've been to so many conferences now in so many cities. It just runs together. And I, you know, it's difficult for me to remember, you know, what I was doing at the year we were in St. Louis, or the year we were in San Francisco, or Phoenix. I remember, like I said, the rain during the conference. And then afterwards, I was very, very friendly with Riley Stardon. And him and his family and my wife and I, and I'm not, I think our kids were there. I'm not positive. But anyhow, we took a ride up to, is it Red Rock? Red Rock Canyon, north of Phoenix?
I'm not sure. I should know that. I live
yeah,
there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, anyhow, we took a ride up there, and he was somewhat familiar with the area. And we had a great time. We had a wonderful time with the Stardons. So those are the two things that stand out to me. And I also played the golf tournament down there, and we played the Phoenician. The Phoenician's the only one that I remember. It's not called the Phoenician now. But anyhow, I played the golf tournament, had a wonderful time, met a few more people. And overall, it was a great experience. I have nothing negative that I recall happened in Phoenix.
and kind of close it, and Don, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the backbone of the family, your wife, Joan, and your kids. Yeah. Talk about them and the support they've given you through the years. And
they've all been great. My son, Donnie, I had him work for me down at Weston. He was like my little slave. And anything that I felt somebody else didn't want to do or wouldn't be happy doing, hey, Don, can you take care of that? So, you know, he'd take care of that. And he had some buddies that hung around with, and he brought them to work for us too. So that worked out well. And he's married and happily into his own career. And our daughter, Kristen, she's now living out in California, and she's a nurse. She loves the profession. And my wife, Joan, and her talk virtually every day. So we're fairly close. We're geographically, you know, a 5-hour ride from my son, and, you know, half a day's flight to go out to California. But they had a good time. They met some people that we still see. We see the Lions. We see that family. Cadinelli's, see them all the time. And Cadinelli kids, now obviously adults, swap stories with my kids. And we find out some of the things that they did. I had no idea, you know, where all this stuff came from and how they pulled it off. Because, you know, I was really like busy doing other things, and the kids didn't care what I was doing as long as I wasn't bothering them. They were having a good time. So the kids got to, you know, each of the families got to meet other kids and the adults, and we're still very, very friendly. I mean, we see Dennis Lyon, and I see Steve Cadinelli all the time. And occasionally I'll see some of the other past board members and people at the various activities in the Northeast. So that's kind of it.
Well, Don Hearn, CGCS 51st president of the GCSAA, thank you so much for joining me and us on the GCSAA podcast today. We really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you, Howard. I had a good time. The time really flies. And hopefully I haven't bored you to death.
No, never, Don. It's always great to be around you and with you and chatting with you. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you, Howard. I'll see you soon. I'll see you in end of January.
Look forward to it. Thanks, Don.
Thank you.
Our thanks once again for tuning into this episode of the GCSA podcast. I want to thank Don Hearn for taking the time to sit down with us to discuss his legendary golf course management career. And I want to thank GCM's Howard Richmond for taking over the hosting duties for this episode. We've got a bunch of irons in the fire as we plan our future episodes of the podcast, including our annual State of the Association chat with GCSAA CEO Rhett Evans next month, and a series of live recordings of this and other superintendent-hosted podcasts on the GCSAA podcast stage at the 2024 Conference and Trade Show in Phoenix, which runs January 29th through February 1st. For now, though, we will say goodbye with a thank you to our podcast editor, Evan Shapiro, to everyone at Enview for their ongoing sponsorship of the podcast, to the GCSAA Board of Directors and all my coworkers at Association Headquarters in Lawrence, Kansas, and of course, my thanks to each of you for subscribing, downloading, and listening. Until next time, happy holidays to you and yours, and we'll catch up again soon on the next episode of the GCSAA podcast.